overnight, and then the new day on Saturday provides you with a blustery breeze and copious amounts of showers, some of these quite heavy in their own right. Wee bit of sunshine will get your temperature to 12. And for Scotland, well, the cloud at its thickest, the rain at its heaviest across western parts to start off the day. But here, rather like England, with time, I think some of that rain in the west will disintegrate into something more showery. The east always seeing that combination of sunny spells and showers. A high on the day here of 12.
My barbecue's been rebranded to something more like an indoor picnic, I'm afraid. In Northern Ireland, we would say that that forecast would leave you foundered and scunnered, basically cold and fed up, and I bet I'm not the only one. But we can't blame you, Philip. I don't think so, anyway. Good night.
Good night.
Now, Tim McInerney reads the final episode of our Book of the Week, A Sting in the Tail. Animals and insects, in particular bumblebees and their survival, have been Professor Dave Goulson's lifelong passion. In 2002, he bought a dilapidated farmhouse in the Charente region of France to create a wildlife-friendly habitat. And as the wildflower meadow begins to develop, Dave finds himself with some surprising and very welcome visitors.
Chez Nauche, the official name of the farm, is the most peaceful place. Outside the front door, the only evidence that there are other humans in the world is the vapour trails in the blue sky above and the occasional distant chug of a farmer's tractor. Wall lizards scurry along the south-facing front of the house, snatching flies and fighting territorial battles. At night, garden dormice, beautiful and incredibly agile creatures with the face markings of a miniature badger, chirr at one another while eating grapes from the vines I've trained over the walls, while glowworms emit their phosphorescent green light from among the cracks in the old flagstone path. Late in the first summer after buying the property, I was surveying the rather splendid view across the fields when I heard a distinctive high-pitched buzz. There were tall pink willow herb in flower, and there, foraging, I was delighted to see a shrill carder bee. This species is a great rarity in the UK. To have them living on my farm in France was wonderful. Very slowly, over the last decade, the meadows have begun to fill with flowers. It has been frustratingly slow. Even if conditions are suitable, the flowers have to come from somewhere, and this limits how fast they return. Some, such as poppies, can survive for years as seed in the soil, but most of the perennial plants that typically thrive in a flower-rich meadow cannot, so seeds have to arrive from elsewhere. Some flowers have seeds which readily disperse over a huge distance. Dandelions are a well-known example. Their seeds hang below a fluffy pappus of fine hairs and can drift for miles on the wind. The meadow is now a sheet of yellow in June and July, but only from late morning through the afternoon, for these flowers close overnight and they are not early risers. Wild carrot followed close behind. The seeds are light and flattened and so can blow a short distance on the wind. Cowslip seeds are heavy and round, so they will always fall close to their parent. From a bumblebee's perspective, legumes are among the most vital components of a wildflower meadow. Plants of this family include clovers, trefoils and vetches, as well as garden vegetables such as peas and beans, and they have an unusual trick which allows them to thrive in low fertility soils. Their roots have nodules, small lumps, inside which live rhizobium, bacteria which can trap nitrogen from the air and turn it into a form usable by plants. Some bumblebee species, such as the brown-banded carder, the garden bumblebee and the ruderal bumblebee, seem to get nearly all of their pollen from legumes. What is so special about legume pollen? To find out, I gathered pollen samples from various different flowers, a remarkably tricky business which bees make look ridiculously easy, and sent them off to a lab in Cambridge where their nutritional composition was analysed. It turned out that legume pollen is especially rich in protein. Since pollen is the only source of protein available to bees, it makes perfect sense for them to selectively visit the flowers which provide the richest source. The relationships between bees, the flowers that they pollinate, and the bacteria that live within the roots of those plants are at the heart of the functioning of a natural species-rich meadow. The problem is that these relationships can be ruined by application of a sack of fertiliser. This allows the grasses to swamp the legumes and other wildflowers, swiftly resulting in a bright green, flowerless sward with no legumes, no rhizobium, and no bees. It has been incredibly rewarding to watch the large but rather dull grassy field that I bought a decade ago slowly turn into a flower-rich sward. With the arrival of plentiful flowers, a myriad of insects have returned. Most insects can fly, and so it does not take them long to find good habitat when it is present. The field is now alive with butterflies every summer, including many which I would have regarded as spectacular prizes in my butterfly collecting days. Swallowtails soar powerfully over the field, searching for fennel on which to lay their eggs. Scarce swallowtails, with more angular wings and a slightly scorched appearance that gives them their French name, le flambé, swoop around my peach trees. Their larvae eat the leaves, which doesn't do the trees any good, but I can't begrudge such beautiful creatures. So far, I have recorded over 60 species of butterfly, almost as many as live in the whole of the British Isles. On the ground, chubby black field crickets sit outside their burrows, their more melodic chirrups drowned out by the bush crickets. They have enormous, oversized heads, which make them resemble cartoon characters. On a warm summer's evening, male stag beetles fly clumsily past, their wings barely able to carry the weight of their heavily armoured bodies. They seem to suffer an appalling mortality rate, for the local kestrels snatch them from the air and settle on the hay bales in the field to dismember them. In some years, every bale has two or three stag beetle heads on it. The heads seem to be too tough to eat. Distressingly, the heads remain alive for a day or two, their antennae twitching and their huge jaws slowly opening and closing. The bumblebees have also returned en masse. Shrill carders are now an everyday sight, hardly worth interrupting one's ablutions for. Red-shanked carders are also tout a centime, distinguished from the even more common red-tailed bumblebees by the red hairy bristles on their legs. The long-tongued ruderal bumblebees remain scarce, but regularly put in an appearance, feeding mainly on the red clover. All of these species are exceedingly rare in Britain, so it is a joy to see them thriving here. I have planted a row of lavender along the front of the house under the windows, so I do not even need to leave my picnic bench by the front door to see a plethora of butterflies, hummingbird hawk moths, and bumblebees. In July of 2009, I was enjoying a morning coffee when I spotted a slightly unusual-looking bee on the lavender. I think my heart knew what it was before my head had really had time to take in the details. It was, unmistakably, a short-haired bumblebee. There are very few places in Europe where these bees are regularly seen, and to my knowledge, Western France was not supposed to be one of them, but nonetheless, here it was. Imagine my excitement and the frenzied rush to grab my camera so that I could record the moment. Of course, we can't turn the whole of Europe into a wildflower meadow, but surely we can find room for a few more meadows like this one, where the multitude of interactions between bees, flowers, bacteria, snakes, mammals, birds, and much else besides can be restored in all its glorious complexity. If you've never done it before, find yourself a wildflower meadow. Although they are scarce, there is probably one not too far away. Go on your own, sit down in the long grass, and soak it all up. Take in the sounds, the buzzing of the bees, the chirping of the grasshoppers, the high-pitched screeches of fighting shrews deep in the grass, the melodic warble of skylarks silhouetted high above. Savour the scents of basil and thyme and lady's bedstraw crushed underfoot, and of the flowers all around. Take in the gentle riot of colours, mauves, yellows, purples and pinks. It is as near to heaven as most of us are ever likely to get. What more reason could we need to create and look after such places? I began studying bumblebees not because they are important pollinators, but because they're fascinating, because they behave in interesting and mysterious ways, and because they are rather lovable. But as I became more familiar with what was known about them, it was made clear that they were in urgent need of help. I began to wonder if I could do something practical about declining bee numbers. How could I persuade farmers to grow more flowers, or convince policymakers of the need for agri-environmental policies which support bees and other wildlife, or convince staff in local councils to mow verges less frequently? One day in 2005, it occurred to me that the solution might be to start a membership-based charity devoted to bumblebee conservation. I couldn't think of a better title than the Bumblebee Conservation Trust, which had to be abbreviated to BBCT, since BCT was taken by the Bat Conservation Trust. A few months later, we had 500 members and several thousand pounds in the bank. The trust now has 11 staff and has 8,000 members all over the UK and a scattering overseas. To date, the trust has been involved in creating in the region of 2,000 hectares of flower-rich habitat at sites from Orkney to Kent and Caithness to Pembrokeshire, most of it in our target areas, where endangered bumblebee species occur. The trust has focused on working with existing landowners and managers, raising awareness of the presence of rare species in particular areas, and encouraging creation of new patches of flower-rich habitat wherever possible. Gardens cover nearly 1 million hectares in the UK, so if we can make even a small fraction of them more bumblebee-friendly, then we can have a major impact. Bumblebees seem to be doing pretty well in urban areas compared to the countryside, probably because there tend to be more flowers and nesting opportunities in gardens than in farmland. However, some gardens are terrible for bumblebees. Low-maintenance decking, gravel, tarmac and concrete cover many, while carefully manicured lawns are also pretty much useless. Modern bedding plants have been intensively selected for size and colour, and in so doing, they have lost their nectar, or become grossly misshapen or oversized, so that it is impossible for bees to get to the rewards. As an example, the small, delicate wild pansy is popular with bumblebees, while the huge, showy blooms of cultivated pansies are ignored. So-called F1 hybrids are often sterile, having no pollen. Double varieties have extra petals, which prevent bees from getting into the flower. For these reasons, most of the busy lizzies, lobelias, petunias, begonias and so on, which are sold as plug plants in the spring to provide an instant splash of colour, are more or less useless to bees or butterflies. They have lost their original function, which was to attract pollinators. Yet there are many flowers which are easy to grow and which are also great for bees. In general, old-fashioned cottage garden perennials are the ones to go for, particularly garden herbs. Lupins, hollyhocks, scabious, lavender, chives, sage, thyme and rosemary, comfrey, viper's bugloss, foxgloves, aquilegia. A single lavender bush on a patio or in a window box will attract and feed bumblebees, even in the heart of a city. This is about creating a future environment for our children to enjoy, where there are still flowers, bees, butterflies and birds, and healthy crops to eat. It is the threat of extinction of large mammals such as the tiger or rhinoceros which tends to capture the public's attention. But arguably, it is the loss of the smaller creatures that should give us most concern. Insects are responsible for delivering numerous ecosystem services, such as pollination and decomposition, and there is no doubt that little life on Earth, including ourselves, could survive without them. As the famous biologist E.O. Wilson said, "If all mankind were to disappear, the world would regenerate back to the rich state of equilibrium that existed 10,000 years ago. If insects were to vanish, the environment would collapse into chaos. Perhaps if we learn to save a bee today, we can save the world tomorrow."
Tim McInerney was reading the final episode of our Book of the Week, A Sting in the Tail by Dave Goulson. It was abridged by Libby Spurrier, produced by Joanna Green, and was a peer production for BBC Radio 4. Now, the shipping forecast issued by the Met Office on behalf of the Maritime and Coast Guard Agency at 0015 on Saturday, the 11th of May. There are warnings of gales in Plymouth, Seoul, Lundy, Fastnet, Rockall and Malin. The general synopsis at 1800. Low Viking, 998, slow moving, losing its identity by 1800 Saturday. Low Hebrides, 997, expected Fair Isle with little change by same time. The area forecast for the next 24 hours. Viking, cyclonic 4, becoming southeast 5 or 6, occasional rain, fog patches at first, moderate or good, occasionally very poor at first. North at Sierra, south at Sierra, east 40s. Southerly, 4 or 5, rain or showers, fog patches, moderate or good, occasionally very poor.